Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:06 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 5th, and today, Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought we'd kick off with the outlook for central bank balance sheets. It's up to 24.4 trillion. So up only, just about 5 trillion in the space of 4 months. And I guess another way to think about it is that it's taken global liquidity up about 25% in the space of 4 months. So that's a lot of money. That if you can't buy a recovery in stocks with 4.5 trillion, then you really are in trouble. So that's what we've seen. But it has been, this is really only a tiny fraction of the kind of assistance that's being provided, because it's not just about the amount of money that has in fact been added to the central bank balance sheets, but rather the promise of more. And I think that is one of the less appreciated points that's worth covering. But of course, it's not just about central bank balance sheets, it's also about the willingness of governments to expand their respective deficits. And this has been popping on the upside. It's up to now 1.9 trillion. Now, this is a measure that doesn't get updated all that often. It does get updated when a country announces its deficit, but this doesn't happen with sufficient regularity to give us an even chart. But one thing that we can certainly think about is that we are at the highest deficits recorded for the same countries that are included in that central bank balance sheets composite chart that we've ever seen. In fact, you have to go all the way back to 2000 before there is any real evidence that on aggregate governments were able to turn in a positive figure. And we are now running at historically wide deficits. 1.9 trillion on a quarterly basis globally. So we add that on to the over 4 trillion from central bank balance sheets. Then, of course, there is the additional promise that, for example, in here this week, the ECB announced that they're going to expand their quantitative easing program by an additional 600 billion. But that was important for confidence in the willingness of the ECB to continue to support markets, but they haven't spent the first 750 billion yet. So a lot of what's going on right now is about signaling what kind of assistance is going to be forthcoming. And that also has to be taken into account when we look at, for example, the fact that the Federal Reserve said that they were going to buy bonds, corporate bonds, and that then unlocked over $1 trillion worth of issuance from the corporate sector without the Federal Reserve really having to buy very many of the bonds at all. I think it was only to the order of about $1.2 billion relative to the $1 trillion worth of spending. Now, this promise to continue to support markets is by far the most important point that is animating investor interest right now. Because what we saw in here today was that unemployment figures in the USA came in much better than expected. There had been a consensus that unemployment would rise to approximately 20% in the USA, and instead it fell to about 13%. So that is an historically wide miss for the economist profession. It also helps to highlight that a number of the people who were classified as unemployed were merely furloughed, and that they are being taken back on as lockdowns end. And lockdowns are ending. There is also the very clear question that is now arising. What is that exactly is going to happen when the economy starts to pick back up? Now, we're starting to have that question asked in the bond markets, because 10-year yields today were positive, and the 30-year was up nearly 10 basis points at one point. Now, we are finishing out the day off the high on the yield. It was only up about 5 basis points, having been up 10 basis points earlier in the day. But here's the question. We don't know to what extent investors are looking at a discount rate for equities, because one of the biggest consensus conclusions back in March was that there was no discount rate that we could use because there had been a concerted effort by central banks everywhere to cut interest rates to the bone, that the rational way of looking at markets and thinking about what kind of return was possible over a discount rate defined by government bond yields was no longer efficacious because it was so low. But it's potentially now a question that government bond yields are likely to rise if economic potential starts to come in above expectations, that with lockdowns ending, there will be a clear intention to just get back out there and experience some fresh air on your face, to start to think about what kind of activities can start to move back into the forefront again. Just excuse me for 1 minute, I'm going to cough. Well, what we have now is government bonds that are starting to price in that the Federal Reserve is less likely to want to buy additional bonds if economic activity improves. But then you have the real fact that the Trump administration is going to go back to Congress and ask for an additional $1 trillion in stimulus. That is already less than the Democrats had supply or had proposed. They had proposed upwards of $3 trillion of additional spending. Well, these are large sums of money, but if the economy is coming in better than expected, then the sustainability of debt is going to start to become an issue, and particularly if bond yields rise. And I think the important point here is that it is at the long end of the curve that bond yields are starting to rise. Now, the 30-year got up to test the region of the trend mean in here today. It was really only about 15 basis points away from it. 2% is an awfully big psychological level for the 30-year, and having pushed through the 1.5% level earlier this week, we're probably due a little consolidation. But it is all contingent on the Federal Reserve coming through and buying the bonds that the Treasury is in fact issuing, and that suggests that there is going to be a significant additional purchase program from the Federal Reserve, and that the size of the balance sheet is going to continue to trend higher. The Fed's balance sheet is now over $7 trillion from just over $4 trillion at the beginning of March, and that trend continues to push higher. And that is the primary reason why the stock market continues to do well. It's less about the health of the economy and much more about betting that the central bank is going to continue to buy the bonds. Now, the big question that was overhanging the market when we go back and think about what people were thinking about when the Trump administration was engaged in pro-cyclical policies and was massively expanding the deficit in a mature cycle. Well, the Federal Reserve then tried to raise interest rates and reduce the size of the balance sheet to countermand the stimulative effects of this impressive fiscal stimulus. There was a real worry among macro investors that there was not going to be enough of ammunition in the central bank's arsenal to try and combat a recession. But what we have instead seen is that the quantity of assistance has simply been ramped up into unimaginably large numbers previously. And that is obviously depressing the purchasing power of the currency. So, on the one hand, we continue to see that nominal prices continue to be supported by the belief that the Federal Reserve is going to ramp up its purchases of bonds again and will engage in yield curve manipulation in order to control for the potential for additional sell-offs. Now, the yield curve spread popped through the 50 basis point level yesterday, and it was in additional positive territory in here today. It is now trending higher. One thing that I think is particularly relevant that we do need to pay attention to is that it is usually when the yield curve spread has been surging through the 50 basis point level following an inversion, and we did have a brief inversion on the 2 and 10 year, well, that's usually when stock markets experience trouble. Now, we're not seeing that right now because the Federal Reserve has been so aggressive in buying bonds, and that we've had a significant setback in the stock market already. Obviously, the question, therefore, is how or when the Federal Reserve is going to provide that additional assistance. They haven't done it yet. Now, with additional interest coming through in the risk assets represented by the stock market, there has been less demand for gold. And gold in US dollars is now back at the lower side of the range that has persisted since April. But it is being supported by the weakness of the US dollar. The simple fact of the matter is that the dollar has been pulling back for the last 10 sessions. Now, we do have a short-term oversold condition, so we may see some steadying coming through over the next week. But it is looking increasingly likely that we are going to see additional weakness coming through from the dollar because of the clear requirement from the central bank to continue to buy bonds, because to do otherwise would result in yields popping on the upside, and that would have a very significant deleterious effect on the ability of the government to sustain its debt through taxation. At the minimum, we're likely to see a significant additional desire to raise taxes after the next election, and that is usually when we do see these things coming through. If we think about the 4-year presidential cycle, what we generally see is that the first year of the presidential cycle is among the worst, and that is because what we see is that governments generally tend to clear the Augean stables, and they try to front load any corrective measures that are required for the budget into the first year, so that by the time it gets around to the fourth year, then that has been forgotten and they've already been stimulating. The third year of the US presidential cycle is often the best, because it's the second half of the third year is usually the best, because you usually get a growth scare at the beginning of the third year. What happens in the first year is that they start to introduce taxes, and the Federal Reserve starts to withdraw some stimulus. Then, by the time you get into the second year, all of that has been biting. You get a growth scare in the first half of the third year. That necessitates that monetary policy has to ease again, and potentially taxes are cut. Our government spending increases to try and boost the economy heading into the next presidential election. You then start to see the stock market doing better in the second half of the third year, which is really what we had in the second half of 2019. And usually the fourth year is among the best. Now, obviously, we've had the hiatus that has been created because of the coronavirus. But historically, the fourth year of the presidential cycle is usually the best because politicians want to get re-elected, and there's not much resistance to additional stimulative measures because politicians from both sides will try to take credit for additional spending measures. Well, that's really what we're seeing right now. We're seeing massive fiscal measures. We're seeing politicians compete with one another to try and offer additional stimulative measures. And then we have the central bank also massively increasing the size of its balance sheet and its purchase program. Now, there is a substantial supply of bonds that is coming online because of treasury issuance. It's around the same time that the Federal Reserve has, in fact, stopped buying and been buying less. Well, they're going to have to ramp up that supply, excuse me, that absorption of the supply. We have a similar condition in Europe. But the most important point right now is that central bankers are primed to buy more. That is the clear belief of stock market investors, and it's going to have to happen in order to continue to support prices. We had a very deep oversold condition in March, and that has been rapidly unwound. The S&P 500 is now clearly back above the 3,000 level, and it didn't pause at that point for very long. When we look at the 1,000-day moving average, it spent about 4 weeks below it and has popped back above it. It is now back above the 200-day moving average, so this is quite positive. It could now consolidate above 3,000, and that would be really an ideal scenario. Alternatively, it could continue higher in much the same way that the Nasdaq is. The Nasdaq pushed on to new all-time highs in here today, and it is really quite overbought in the short term as it approaches the big psychological 10,000 level. It is not at all beyond the bounds possibility that we get some consolidation in this area, but there's not a lot of evidence to support that view until we in fact see a clear downward dynamic. The Philadelphia Semiconductors Index also pushed on to new high ground in here today and is closing above the psychological 2,000 level for the first time. When we then look at just a more concentrated view of the largest companies that have been doing best, the FAANG index, and I don't seem to be typing with particularly good effectiveness, but it is now also at a new high as it comes up to that 4,000 level. These are the shares that have done best from the incredible quantity of money that is poured into the market and the reliance of people who have been locked up at home on remote access to the internet, to communication technology and entertainment. So that has certainly played into the hands of the largest companies in the world. The continued recovery in the economy is obviously something that is going to be essential for the valuations that have been taken on to be justifiable in any real way. There is the potential, of course, that we are at a point now where there is going to be a clear effort to monetize debts, and that is very similar to what we had in the early 1970s. When we go back and think about modern monetary theory, and there was a substantial ruckus about it 2 years ago, now we're looking at a point where it is very clearly the reality. And governments are simply printing the money they require in order to placate restive populations. Now, this restive populations issue has is something that has been developing for most of the last 4 years. The first populist administration that came into any major country was Narendra Modi in India, and that was 6 years ago. Now we are looking at street protests on in every major city in America, some of which have turned violent, which have focused on police brutality and racism, but are unlikely to really have emerged in such a popular manner were it not for the fact that you have 40 million people that have been sitting at home twiddling their thumbs and that are protesting not only at the inequality and racism inherent in society, but also at the fact that they're unemployed, that they are having a difficult time surviving, and that they're angry at everything. It is another example of the clarion call of disenfranchised populations everywhere, which is, what about me? And that has been the rallying cry for populist movements right across Europe. Europe wouldn't have had that if it hadn't been for their very aggressive austerity regime. Now, the entire raison d'etre for forcing peripheral countries to absorb private sector debts was to try and avoid a default cycle that would have put extraordinary pressure on the pension programs of creditor nations. Well, instead, what it has done has been to create a very significant backlash, particularly in the peripheral nations. Well, Europe is now, I think, dispensing with the fiscal straitjacket. Now, that was a potential outcome that most people were appalled by when they looked at the record that Germany has for fiscal probity. Then they just did not believe that it was possible that they would ever subscribe to the potential to bail out some of the peripheral countries. And yet that is exactly what we're seeing. Now, the important point, though, is that despite the fact that we've had this really incredible move in terms of Germany subscribing to, and France, to the view that they need to provide assistance to countries like Italy and Spain, that has really contributed to faith that potentially Europe will be able to handle its significant issues. But it has also resulted in the potential that Europe could outperform the USA. Now, we've had a very significant run-up in the euro over the course of the last 10 sessions. It is now back at the first area of potential resistance around the peak from early March, around 114. So we are likely to get some consolidation here. But the much bigger picture is that it has broken the two-year downtrend. We are back in the region of the upper side of the range that persisted between 2015 and 2016. Now, Europe might not want the strongest currency in the world, but it is looking increasingly likely that the USA does want to have a weak currency. And there is no country wants a strong currency, but there's some need a weaker one more than others. And right now, the USA needs a weaker currency. Now, it is weakening, I think, significantly more against other currencies than it is compared to the euro. So the Australian dollar has rallied really very significantly. Now, it is pausing around the 70 cent level, and we may see an additional pause over the next few weeks. But the reality here is that Australia has come through the coronavirus in flying colors, that there is the potential that demand for the commodity exports that support the economy is going to recover. And that should be beneficial for the currency overall. So we have probably seen a low of medium-term significance for the Australian dollar. And when we look at the New Zealand dollar, then it is a reasonably similar story. It hasn't quite yet been able to break the downtrend. It's been more volatile overall in terms of the downtrend since early 2018, but this has been a very meaningful rebound. Then when we look at other currencies like the Russian ruble, they have, and particularly those that have got an energy focus like the Canadian dollar or the ruble, or indeed the Brazilian real, then they have got similar conditions of significant rebounds. And that is being led by oil prices. And oil has found a low of, I think, medium-term significance. Below $20 was a rather extraordinary condition. And now there is the clear potential that it is going to rebound and potentially back up towards $60. So this is a very significant trough-to-peak swing. I continue to be of the opinion that we are likely to see more ranging than trending for the foreseeable future. It's been my view for most of the last 4 or 5 years that natural gas offers a very close analog for what we might anticipate from oil prices, where there is a very significant pickup from the lower side of the range, and that there is clear resistance when it gets back up towards the $5 and $6 area. And that's been the case in natural gas now for most of the last 12 years. So if that is an analog for what we can anticipate from oil prices, it means that any source of supply that relies on prices north of $70 is not going to be coming back to the market. So there's going to be a significant rationalization in the shale sector. Then there's also going to be a rationalization in the range of global suppliers, and the cheaper ones will obviously survive. It means that there's going to be a significant amount of supply shut in, and that will last until technology improves to the point where it will become realizable at prices closer to $50, or it's just going to sit there indefinitely. But the supply of resources, particularly oil, is likely to be contained, and that is helping to support prices. It's also supporting the value of those currencies. So now when we then think about how gold is performing, well, gold has been reasonably steady against the US dollar. Now the bigger question is, when we look at it against some of those currencies that have been rebounding, it is back in the region of the trend mean against the Australian dollar, and it is unwinding its overbought condition relative to the trend mean against the pound. When we look at it in Indian rupees, then the rupee has been quite steady, so it looks almost identical to the US dollar. When we look at it against the Japanese yen, then it's also had, well, continued to have an upward bias, but it was down in here today. But Japan hasn't had a very significant move in the currency, whereas the Brazilian real has certainly rallied, the Canadian dollar has certainly rallied, and that is putting downward pressure on gold in those currencies. Now, when we think about the renminbi, the Chinese are quite alert to the fact that the US dollar is being downgraded, and the renminbi has been stronger over the course of the last few days versus the US dollar. However, it is still lower than the trend mean, and I think it is unlikely that Chinese are going to allow the renminbi to trade very much below the 7 level, or stronger than the 7 level. When we then think about how is the euro doing versus the renminbi, then I think we're provided with some additional information. It popped on the upside yesterday. It didn't quite hold the advance. the Chinese are much more alert to how the renminbi is performing against the euro because much more of their exports go to Europe than they do to the USA. Europe is obviously also sensitive to that. So this 8 level has been an area of resistance now for 3 years. It is short-term overbought, so the euro does look like we're going to see some consolidation here. But China needs a weaker currency. And when we look at it in a range of additional currencies, the yen, for example, has been weaker over the course of this week and closed just below the psychological 110 level. When we look at the renminbi, then there is the potential also that the yen will weaken against it. There's the additional important trade cross rate, like the yen and the Korean won. So we also are looking at the potential that Japan is going to try and devalue their currency. When we look at the Nikkei, it has pushed back above the 20,000 level. It is now that is clearly signaling the failed downside break. It is rallying rapidly now back up towards the upper side of its range. When we look at this on a long-term basis, the Nikkei has been ranging above 20,000 for the last 2.5 years, but it ranged below 20,000 for more than 20 years before that. So this continues to look like a first step above the base, despite the fact that we had a significant hiatus in the second quarter of the year. Then the TOPIX index has been underperforming the Nikkei, but it is now coming back up towards the peaks that we've seen on previous occasions. If we can see the TOPIX breaking successfully above the 1800 level, then that will be additional confirmation that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The second section index, which is smaller cap companies, has generally tended to lead, and it is now right in the region of its trend mean. So there is, I think, the potential here that both the USA and Japan are going to try and devalue their currencies. Europe might not be happy about letting the euro strengthen, but the potential here is that Japan is going to engage in a trillion-dollar stimulus package. They're going to try and outstrip the Europeans in terms of their monetary and fiscal stimulus. And then there is the potential, therefore, that investors will start to look on Europe as more of a recovery candidate. Now, the Euro Stoxx index was up in a very dynamic manner in here this week, and it's the biggest upward move we've seen in terms of this entire recovery since March. And it's closing out the week right in the region of the trend mean. There is the potential now that Europe is going to start to do better. And it is the first time in years that the stock market has been doing better with a firm currency. Because over the course of the last 5 years, the only time that Europe has done better was when the euro was going down. And that changed in here over the last 10 days. That is a very significant development because Europe trades at a very wide valuation disparity compared to Europe. The Europe Stoxx 600, which includes, it's a pan-European index, not just a Eurozone index, it has a yield of 2.84%. The FTSE 100 has a yield of 4.37%, and the S&P 500 has a yield of 1.9%. So there is obviously a yield benefit to investing in Europe. Now you have the currency with you as well, despite the short-term potential for some consolidation. Commodity-related currencies are back on the ascendancy. The Latin America dollar index has rallied over the course of, by about 10% over the course of the last month and is unwinding its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. Copper prices have pushed back above the $2.50 area and are testing the region of the trend mean. So this is also an area of potential resistance, potential room for some consolidation. Nickel prices rallied last week to break the 8-month downtrend and were in additional positive territory in here today. So there are certainly some bets being put in place that are supportive of the view that regardless of what happens, the range of plans that governments have to try and get as many people back to work in as short a time as possible is going to include infrastructure development. And that's positive for all industrial resources. That's going to be true of China in the first instance, then Europe, then the USA. There is likely to be a great deal of infrastructure development, and not least because roads and dams and power plants that were built 50 years ago are reaching the end of their product cycle and need to be replaced. There is going to be little, I think, opposition to spending additional money on big pieces of capital infrastructure that have the potential to reap economic rewards over the long term. So that is really quite supportive of the potential for commodities to start to make a comeback. We've also had meaningful moves in soft commodities, and rough rice has been among the best performers, but the contract change represented a very significant step down in the price. So that could potentially now be over, that there was some fear that there might be a short-term shortage of rice. One thing I have noticed, though, is that 2020 harvests have been turning up in supermarkets. So that suggests that some of the export restrictions on the high-quality Thai jasmine rice have actually been easing. So I think perhaps that part, that supply and elasticity argument, is now over. Then when we think about the very significant pop on the upside we've had in orange juice, that one does still appear to have legs, and it has clearly broken its downtrend. China has been buying soybeans, and the price has been firming from the lower side of the almost 2-year range that's been forming over just above the 800 level. Then wheat is always a commodity that is worth monitoring because it represents a staple food for a very significant number of people, and the price has that rounding characteristic over the last 6 years that is quite similar to the kind of base formation we had in gold. Well, let's then go back and think about gold, because it has been among the strongest performers over the course of the last 6 months. It is a monetary commodity, and as a monetary metal, it does best when it is appreciating against all currencies. Well, it's not appreciating against all currencies right now, but it is coming back to areas of support against the majority. Whatever way we cut it, there is going to be a clear and concerted effort to debase the purchasing power of fiat currencies. Now, while investors at the moment are willing to look past that because of the rebound that we're getting from some of the most oversold conditions, I think that, for example, when we look at the airlines index, we've had some incredible moves this week where some of the individual airlines have moved 10 and 20 and even 30% in a day, but they were not able to hold onto their advance in here today. And they certainly have the potential to be the kinds of companies that are going to experience a great deal of ranging. So it's usually this kind of move off of an incredibly accelerated decline that chastens the bears. So it's quite likely that the lows are in. But to get from $40 to $100 seems like an awfully big ask. Then when we look at, for example, a company like Macy's, it popped on the upside immediately after news that their flagship store in Manhattan had been looted earlier this week. And it was in a positive mood again in here today, although again, not off its highs. Now, it is ground central for the ravaging of the brick and mortar retail sector, because how likely is it that people are going to rush back to a company like Macy's when their products are not competitively priced compared to some of the discounters that sell very similar goods? TJX, on the other hand, has rebounded in emphatic fashion and is back in the region of its trend mean. This is the big differentiation. There will be winners and losers. There will be companies that are going to come through this hiatus in economic activity in a stronger position. And the ones that lead off the lows are generally those that are going to do best in a recovery scenario. Even the worst performers are capable of bouncing in an emphatic and impressive fashion. But if they are only just starting to do it now, it's the bigger question is whether they represent trading opportunities or investment opportunities. It's not like Macy's is suddenly going to turn around and become the go-to retailer for consumers for the next decade. That just seems to be unlikely. Rather, it's quite likely that they're going to experience prolonged difficulty and that they're going to try and monetize their substantial real estate assets. But that's that's the kind of strategy that points towards eventual bankruptcy. When we then think about some of the staple type of companies that have obviously pulled back and then recovered really impressively, we see a substantial number, like McDonald's or Disney for that matter, that are now back in the region of their respective trend means. And now the question is, are they going to push up and through those trend means? These chart patterns are not attractive. When we look at, for example, that Procter & Gamble went from 70 to 130 in an incredibly persistent manner, and then gave up more than half of the decline in the space of a month, and then recouped almost all of it in the space of 3 weeks. Well, obviously, investors are looking at that $120 area and thinking, well, do I really want to pay? Or do I want to be the first person to pay $125 for the share? Will I just simply wait and let someone else do it? The reality is that this impressive advance we've seen over the course of the last while has been driven primarily by retail investors, and that institutions are still very gun-shy. And to me, at least, that suggests that despite the incredible strength we have, if we're going to have an additional run on the upside, it is going to coincide with the central bank coming through and stating that they are going to ramp up additional demand for government bonds. But they haven't done it yet. And they have to be alert to the potential that they are stoking a bubble, because their efforts to try and limit the expansion of our, I guess, to control the yield curve is probably the best way of thinking about it. That represents a massive source of additional liquidity. And with an improving economy, then I just simply, at a number of chart seminars, when this type of conversation has always come up, what I like to do is to take my coffee cup, fill it about three quarters of the way, and start stirring. And the faster you stir, the more, or the, I guess, the more that the coffee inside the cup rises up to test the limb or the rim. If you stir even faster, then it spills, and then you get inflation. Well, we don't have that problem right now, but the market has been flooded. So as long as economic activity continues to increase without central banks withdrawing liquidity, and they're inhibited from doing that because of the massive supply of bonds that are coming through from governments, then the potential here is that we're going to have inflation, and that we're potentially going to have an inflationary outcome at some point next year. So we have incredibly impressive rebounds. We have challenging environments in terms of some of the staples that have had the rebounds but have still not been able to push through. We are at a condition for the NASDAQ 100 where it is 176 points away from the psychological 10,000 level. And it has been incredibly impressive on the upside. One thing that I can definitely, or that I am certainly aware of, is we have an RSI divergence on the weekly chart. And the last time we had something like that was in 2018, before the significant pullback. We also had a divergence in terms of a lower high right at in February. And now we have a significant lower high as the index comes up to test that 10,000 level. What that suggests to me is that the clear temptation is for investors to chase the market, to throw in the towel and say that caution should be thrown to the wind, that there is no point in fighting the Fed. Well, I'm certainly not advocating fighting the Fed, but the Fed is not providing the same amount of assistance right now that it was in March. And it's happening at exactly the same time that there is a massive amount of issuance coming through. And there is the real potential that that is going to cause indigestion. So there will be a better buying opportunity. And waiting for pullbacks is by far the best strategy. Because if investors missed the extreme oversold conditions that were evident right at the end of March, we haven't had a pullback yet. Now, investors are losing their patience, but we have a large number of shares that are at potential areas of resistance. Now, there are two ways of thinking about it. One is that with the market at a new high, that it is possible to buy the breakout. If one is buying the breakout, then it is quite easy to determine how big a position can be justified, because the potential is that we're going to see it fail. So then the position would be closed in the event that the market fails to sustain the upward break. If the breakout is sustained, then it could be added to on weakness, provided then the market continues to hold the breakout. But these are trading strategies, and we know that valuations have increased substantially. The reality now is that we were already in the third psychological perception stage of a bull market back in early 2019. And now we have had a substantial pullback. It has rocked investor confidence, retail investors have surged into that void. The number of trades and new accounts opened for shares like Schwab and TD Ameritrade and Robinhood surged in the last 3 months. So retail investors are plowing into this market, and institutional investors are still really quite gun-shy. We are going to have to see continued support from central banks in order to justify continuing to support these momentum moves. Then when I think we look at some of the most exaggerated moves, I mean, I'm perfectly willing to accept that a lot more people wanted to wear yoga pants when they were isolated at home. But Lululemon is up over 100% in the space of just the last 3 months. And that's an extraordinary condition. I'm still bemused by the continued strength of Shopify. Zoom Media is what I wanted to say. And we are potentially seeing some evidence of continued or some selling pressure coming through there now. Shopify posted a large downside Q reversal 2 weeks ago, and it has not really followed through on the downside, but this looks like a peak of at least near-term significance. Now, this has been one of the most impressive shares on the upside. Investors are looking on it as a potential candidate to challenge Amazon. But even there, it is still overbought, and it is approximately $300 away from, I'm not doing math very well, it's $275 away from the trend mean right now. When we then think about what this means, it suggests that we are due a pullback. Even if this is a breakout that is going to be sustained, it is completely dependent on continued liquidity and the reduced purchasing power of fiat currencies. Gold is consolidating right now, and the best scenario for buying gold is following a pullback, which suggests that we are due a pullback and that it will provide the next good buying opportunity. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.